Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Zone Media.
Welcome to It Could Happen Here, a podcast that, much to the chagrin of my upstairs neighbors, is being recorded at almost 3 in the morning. It's being recorded at 3 in the morning instead of at a normal time because a bunch of protests broke out across college campuses against the genocide in Palestine. We will cover that at some point very soon. However, there is this episode to be done. I'm your host, Mia Wong, and this episode is something a little different. So, there's an element of Trump's Agenda 47 that we didn't really talk about in our episodes. That's actually a pretty significant amount of the material, and that's Trump's trade policy. And this is, sort of surprisingly, a very large part of his pitch. The sort of gist of it is that Trump's appeal to, like, the white working class TM is, okay, we're going to do a bunch of protectionist tariffs. This is going to bring jobs back to the US by imposing costs on manufacturing in other countries, et cetera, et cetera. This will bring jobs back to America and it will make America great or some shit. Now, the centerpiece of this is what's called the Reciprocal Tariff Bill. And it's not that complicated. Basically, what it says is if a country imposes a tariff on an American good, the U.S. imposes an identical tariff on that tariff. It's designed to basically automatically start trade wars. Now, the reason we didn't cover this in the original Agenda 47 slate of episodes is that even in the worst case scenario where Trump takes power in like a coup, and, you know, the sort of power of anyone to oppose him is significantly curtailed, I don't think he can get this one passed. And the reason I don't think he can get this one passed is because, you know, as it turns out, this package, and we're going to sort of explore this a little bit, actually seriously messing with tariffs is something that is really, really going to piss off a lot of corporations that actually matter. Now, okay, so like I could have just done the episode anyways, led with that, and just given a sort of, you know, just given the disclaimer that like it's probably not going to happen. But I think there's a more interesting story here that hasn't really been talked about the origin of basically the framework of modern American politics, both on the right and on the left, because they both emerge, I think, from a series of arguments about trade that has been kind of broadly forgotten. I think that's to our detriment. And the product of this is that there's been a sort of raft of arguments, and I've seen this as much from the left as from the right, that Trump's support for tariffs, and particularly the sort of trade spat he got in with China from 2018 to 2019, marks the end of the sort of like neoliberal free trade regime and the emergence of like new nationalist protections against free trade. It's like the new economic system that's replaced neoliberalism. And I am very skeptical of this. And the reason why I'm very skeptical of this is because when I was coming up as a leftist, I spent a bunch of time, seriously became involved in like IRL left organizing around 2017. I'd done some stuff in like 2013 before then. But that meant that, you know, a lot of the stuff I was reading was accounts of what was called the global justice movement, which was, or alter-globalization, anti-globalization. There's like, it has a million names. But it was this series of mass protest movements against the sort of raft of free trade agreements coming out of the 90s. So, and you get a very, very different picture of the history of free trade that is sort of broader and more expansive in the history of the resistance to it than you get if you just sort of like, you know, assume neoliberalism has been the same always and Trump is the sort of aberration to it. Now, and Trump's status as an aberration is something that I question. I mean, you know, the trade war that he got into is something, you know, it is different, but I think there's a lot of sort of hype around Trump's like opposition to free trade. Like one of the big things, you know, that Trump ran on was pulling out of NAFTA. And he did. He did pull out of NAFTA. However, comma, he then set up a new NAFTA, by the way, is a North American Free Trade Agreement. It's really shit. We're going to talk a bit more about what exactly it did later. But, it's broadly seen, I think, rightly as something that smashed both huge portions of what was left of the American manufacturing economy and, you know, the parts of the economy that had been rebuilt in the 80s, and also just absolutely annihilating the Mexican agricultural industry for reasons that we will explain in a bit. It's now become extremely deeply unpopular because unbelievable numbers of workers lost their jobs, and the jobs that they got afterwards had shittier wages. You know, entire communities are ravaged, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Trump, you know, famously campaigns on pulling out of this deal, but he replaces it with something called USMCA. Now, here's the thing about this deal. This is basically just NAFTA with slightly stronger carve outs for the auto industry about like what percentage of the parts of vehicles have to be produced in the US and some like slightly stronger labor like protections, which is like fine, but it's basically the same deal, right? So, you know, you have to take this whole sort of like, Trump is like the anti-free trade thing with a grain of salt and look at, again, this deal that he negotiated, which is just NAFTA. It is literally, after all of the hype of him pulling out of NAFTA, he did NAFTA again. Now, this is something very interesting that I don't think people remember. Obama also opposed NAFTA and they came into office and then nothing ever fucking happened to NAFTA. So, you know, the sort of like the rumors of NAFTA's demise have been greatly exaggerated. But, comma, the story of the building of opposition to NAFTA is very, very interesting. So something I don't think most people understand is that the modern American left is descended from the Zapatistas, very specifically. We're going to one day cover the Zapatista uprising in some detail, but the sort of Cliff Notes version is that on January 1st, 1994, the Zapatistas, who are, you know, named after the great Mexican revolutionary hero Emilio Zapata, staged an uprising in Mexico. They seized a bunch of cities very quickly. They were sort of driven out of those cities, but eventually they took control of a decent part of the territory of the Mexican state of Chiapas. The Zapatistas staged this uprising for a number of reasons. The most famous of them is that January 1st, 1994 is the year that NAFTA took effect. One of the things about this free trade agreement is that it, in order to ratify it, the Mexican government changed the constitution, and the part of the constitution they eliminated was the part that had secured collective ownership of a bunch of land for indigenous people. And this would allow corporations to seize and control the indigenous land, exploit it for resources, kick the people off of it, and kill them. Now, this obviously was unacceptable to the Zapatistas. They go into revolt. What I think people don't realize is what the Zapatistas did next, which is holding a series of these things called encuentros, like encounters. Sorry, my Spanish is not as good as it once was, and it was never great, but, you know, in which they invited, you know, sort of leftist activists from all over the world to get together. And this is the thing that rebuilt the left after the absolute catastrophe of the death of the old left around the collapse of the Soviet Union, which sort of annihilated, like, the sort of old left, like communist political parties, and, you know, ushered in like the pure era of the march of neoliberalism. And the activists that came out of these encounters go back to their respective countries, and they start, and, you know, they're organizing against these series of free trade deals. And they start doing what's become known as summit hopping. I think the most famous of these in America is what's become known as the Battle of Seattle, the 1999 giant protest against the World Trade Organization summit. Yeah, and this sort of, you know, and this starts from about 1999 to 9/11. There's a huge wave of these. Well, I mean, it goes on after 9/11, but 9/11 really damages it. But there's this massive, it's like really the first sort of real, like, mass mobilizations and social movements, like, in the U.S. since, like, there was the stuff in the anti-nuclear movement in the 80s, but this is the first really big sort of, like, resurrection of the left. And I think importantly for us, like, the people who found Occupy, like David Graeber, for example, is someone who starts doing politics, like, during this period, during alter-globalization, during these sort of protests. And those are the people who build Occupy. And, you know, Occupy, for whatever else you can say about it, Occupy is the single event that brought, that, like, dragged the American left kicking and screaming out of irrelevance. And all of that shit, everything, you know, all of the sort of organizational tenets of Occupy, all of its sort of ideology, that stuff is all stuff from ultra-globalization, right? And the sort of tenets of, like, of direct democracy, of the sort of economic egalitarianism, this opposition to free trade, this whole thing about the way that the World Trade Organization and the World Bank, you know, use sort of economic restructuring deals to devastate economies and, like, turn entire nations into sort of debt peons. This is all ultra-globalization stuff. And this movement is very, very powerful and very successful. Even the sort of arch, like, you know, by the time you hit 2016, right, this has reshaped politics in the U.S. to the extent that, like, arch neoliberal Hillary Clinton says she's openly in favor of renegotiating NAFTA and opposes her own Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is the last of the sort of giant free trade deals that would eventually, like, die and go up in smoke with Trump, right? I'm going to read a passage from David Graeber's piece, The Shock of Victory, about what actually happened during this movement. This is, you know, a section about free trade agreements. All the ambitious free trade treaties planned since 1998 have failed. The MIA was routed, the FTAA, the focus of the actions in Quebec and Miami, stopped dead in its tracks. Most of us remember the 2003 FTAA summit mainly for introducing the quote-unquote Miami model of extreme police repression against even obviously non-violent civil resistance. It was that. But we forget that this was more than anything the enraged flailings of a pack of extremely sore losers. Miami was the meeting where the FTAA was definitively killed. Now, no one is even talking about broad, ambitious treaties on that scale. The US is reduced to pushing for minor country-to-country trade pacts with traditional allies like South Korea and Peru, or at best deals like CAFTA, uniting its remaining client states in Central America, and it's not even clear it will manage to pull that off. And this is what we've seen from, you know, sort of projecting forward from the future from the 2000s when this is written. Free trade was not killed by Trump or Xi Jinping. These free trade agreements, if anyone, was killed by the Zapatistas and the global justice movement that the encontros and the Zapatistas built. Now, one thing the Zapatistas did not build is the products and services that support this podcast.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
And we are back from products and servicing. Products and servicing? That is slightly ominous. Now, the modern left isn't the only thing that sort of descended from the backlash to free trade, right? We've gone over the extent to which the left is built off of this stuff. But much of the modern right is descended from the sort of Ross Perot-like right-wing nationalist backlash to the same stuff. I think probably the most famous link between that era and this era is Alex Jones. This is the reason that, like, Alex Jones and people like him scream constantly about globalists, right? Because, you know, the global justice movement has two kind of wings. What was called anti-globalization. It has two wings. One wing is a leftist wing, which is like, okay, we actually support support the global like movement of ideas and people, but what globalization and free trade actually means is locking people down in their countries with militarized borders while capital moves freely between them, and we think that's fucking bad. There was also another. There was also the right-wing reaction, which is this incredibly right-wing nationalist reaction, which is that these rootless cosmopolitan globalists are taking all of our jobs and moving them to like Mexico, and they've sold out the American people, and this stuff is just it starts as anti-Semitic dog whistles and just gets. Yeah, I mean, these are like the loudest dog whistles of all time, right? But, they get increasingly anti-Semitic. And this is the kind of stuff, that Alex Jones is doing. And this is the kind of sort of right-wing politics that wins out over the sort of like neoconservatism's more like sort of hoorah, free trade. We're going to use the might of the American Empire to spread sort of like this very specific model of capitalism to other countries, and you get this sort of Trump style, like, fuck every other country, we're going to kind of do tariffs and stuff. Now, what I think is very interesting, so what Trump eventually sort of winds up, producing as a discourse, I guess you could say, is this image of, okay, so like the thing that's holding back the American worker is China, because all of our jobs are being sent to China. And so if we just put more tariffs on China and we defeat China geopolitically, everything will sort of like be great in the American nation. Like you, the white worker, are going to have jobs again. Like everything's going to go back to the way they were. And what's fascinating about this is that, as the trade war is intensifying in the mid-late 2010s, in China, there is a parallel discourse, which is almost identical, where Chinese nationalists will do this thing where they talk about, like, breaking through the Great Ming as a solution to involution. We talked about involution on the show before. Is this concept that's very popular in China right now, where, you know, it's becoming increasingly clear that, like, working hard is not going to actually get you any more money than you're getting now. Like, you're not going to get ahead in life. You're just sort of stuck. And so you're stuck in this condition of putting more and more effort into nothing. And the Chinese nationalist argument is that if you can geopolitically defeat the U.S., China will sort of, like, break out of its wage stagnation and economic stagnation. And so, you know, what you have is this very, very dangerous collision of these two sort of, like, right-wing nationalisms that are, like, offering these really sort of categorically false assertions that if you just follow their sort of nationalist geopolitical agenda, then all of the sort of class issues that everyone's dealing with will suddenly magically work themselves out. Now, contra this, and contra, I think, the argument that even that sort of just, you know, the argument that I was talking about before, that, like, Trump and this sort of nationalist, like, economic policy and discourse from China, like, represents something, you know, seismic, like a seismic change in, like, trade policy that signals the end of neoliberalism. I want to come back to the point of, will Trump actually be able to implement any of this stuff, even if he had sort of near dictatorial power? And I think the answer to that is no. And the reason I think the answer to that is no is that, you know, one of the old observations about quote unquote free trade from the global justice movement is that, okay, if you look at what quote unquote trade is, right? International trade. Huge amount of it is literally the same company moving its own resources from one place to another. Now, the problem is the more expensive it is for a corporation to do this, the more pissed off they get, right? And this means that this kind of, like, tariff war bullshit, and this happened during the Trump administration, it pissed off a lot of people. And if you know, and Trump is, you know, his intention is to start an even larger and more powerful series of trade wars. This is going to piss off a lot of people who actually matter in the sort of in the American political system, which is to say a lot of shareholders and a lot of CEOs. And, you know, and so I think the fairly obvious conclusion is that what actually happens here is you get exactly the same kind of shit that happened with Trump's, like, quote unquote pull out of NAFTA, where he makes, like, one or two symbolic gestures and then everything continues as normal and he declares victory. Now, the second problem I have with people looking at this as a sort of new regime is the way that they're thinking about this sort of, like, tariff and subsidy regime as something that's not a part of neoliberalism, right? Like, the sort of theoretical ideal of neoliberalism is countries aren't supposed to do tariffs, countries aren't supposed to be able to do, like, quote-unquote protectionism. So we're not supposed to give subsidies to manufacturers, and everyone's supposed to, like, compete on a free and equal playing field. This has never been true. And in fact, what free trade has meant in practice, and this has been true since the founding of the World Trade Organization, what it means is that Western countries get to impose tariffs and manufacturing subsidies and non-Western countries don't, right? Even in the WTO, there's a bunch of random carve-outs for, like, fucking, like, random workers in Germany and stuff. This is also a part of, like, literally a part of what started the Zapatista uprising. I mean, we talked about, you know, the primary cause, like, the elimination of collective ownership from the Mexican Constitution. But another huge problem is what NAFTA was going to do is force a bunch of Mexican corn farmers to compete with American corn farmers. Now, okay, if it was literally just corn farmers from these two countries competing, like, Mexican corn farmers probably eventually could outcompete American corn farmers because Americans are fucking dog shit at farming. But under the terms of NAFTA, and this is, again, a thing that's been true of free trade this whole time, they have to compete with subsidized American corn. This is impossible. Mexican farmers got fucking annihilated. All of their land was seized by corporations. And, you know, it has brought sort of devastation and ruin to the Mexican economy ever since. This has been absolutely great for the ruling class because all of these farmers who suddenly, like, you know, can't afford to keep their farms anymore were forced into sort of, like, labor and a bunch of shitty sweatshops that were set up from NAFTA. So this worked great from the perspective of American capital. But again, if you look at what actually happened here, right, all of the sort of, like, rhetoric of free trade, you know, like, sort of, like, fades into mist in face of the reality of one of the great industrial policy programs in the history of world economies, which is the American subsidization of its own fucking agriculture. And, you know, this isn't considered in the quote unquote industrial policy or like industrial like government planning or whatever, like largely because people have this weird bias when they talk about government planning that it only is supposed to apply to like, oh, government planning means when like someone like plans steel output or some shit. But like, no, like the actual large scale economic planning that goes on in the US is the unfathomable like billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars that we pour into the agricultural industry every year. So, you know, if you look at the stuff that everyone's claiming are these sort of new innovations that are like the end of neoliberalism, right? It's like, oh my God, other like countries are putting up like protectionist subsidy things. Like they're having their, you know, people are like trying to make microchips and they're having like state sponsored programs to do microchips. It's like, well, they're just doing with microchips what the US has been doing with corn this entire time, right? What's really changing to some extent is that, you know, the deal had always been that Western countries get to impose tariffs and have manufacturing subsidies and non-Western countries don't. And I think part of what's weirding people out is that, like, you know, China has actually been kind of attempting to break the West monopoly on being able to do with industrial policy. And this has caused a bunch of people to really severely overestimate the extent to which, like, this is an actual break from previous regimes of trade and capital. Now, another point that I want to make that I've talked about this before on the show, but I want to kind of briefly touch on it again because I think it's really important and it's really badly understood, is that for all of the sort of discourse about how, like, China's like entering into economic competition with the West and it's like increasingly using the party to like pursue nationalist aims instead of like following the market. If you look at what's actually going on in China, despite all the hype about like, China and the US are decoupling their economies, or like China is trying to make its own domestic silicon industry, the actual tendency in Chinese economic policy is towards further integration and increasing foreign ownership. China has a lot of provisions about foreign companies needing to be in partnership with Chinese companies in order to operate in China. There's always been massive restrictions on how much stock a foreign company can own in Chinese companies. And these restrictions in sector after sector after sector after sector are being lifted. And so you have to sort of look at this, you know, the sort of like surface level nationalist narratives about like, we're entering an era of like warring, like warring mutually exclusive economic trading spheres, with the reality of China being like, no, please, foreign capital, like you can operate here without us. It's going to be great. Just to keep pumping more capital in. If we all work together, if all of the sort of bourgeoisie will keep making money together. And I think all of this leads to something, the last thing I want to touch on, which is what's actually happening here. And the thing that's actually happening here, and the thing that's actually causing all of these sort of like all like the sort of focus on trade itself and the sort of Trumpian nationalist, we can solve all your problems by trade competition. What's happening is that after about the 1960s, because of sort of structural manufacturing overcapacity and underconsumption, production, you know, industrial production is zero sum, right? You can't increase production rates in a country without that, you know, without that production coming at the cost of another country. And this is because, and wow, stop me if you've heard this one before, this is because of fucking capitalism. And what Trump is trying to do, and what, you know, to a lesser extent, sort of Xi Jinping, and what to, you know, these sort of Chinese nationalists are trying to do is turn, you know, they're trying to stand on a beach and order the tide to recede in order to stop the coming class war. They are trying to say, no, we can go back to the era where production wasn't zero sum. We can do this with sort of tariffs. We can go back to the golden age of both corporations and unions making money, or corporations and workers like making money together, and this sort of like national collaborationist project. And they're doing this in large part because they are watching the same thing that you and I are watching, the same thing that's the reason this episode is being recorded at fucking 3 a.m. instead of a normal time, which is that all across the US and, you know, increasingly all across the world, you can fucking see the working class starting to organize again. can see it starting to wake up. You can see it starting to mobilize. And this whole fucking thing, all of Trump, right? This entire sort of racist, xenophobic nationalist project is just utter dread that Ferguson and the Black Revolution put into the fucking hearts of these people. And if we fight hard enough, we fight smart enough, and we fight organized enough, inshallah, we will see the fucking day when these people's nightmare comes true and we never have to hear another word from these fuckers again. This has been It Could Happen Here.
It Could Happen Here is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find sources for It Could Happen Here updated monthly at coolzonemedia.com/sources. Thanks for listening.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.